I suppose the high point of my career was when I finished my graduate work, I got a job.
And I got a job. What was the job?
Calgary, University of Calgary. And it was coming to a place where I'd never been. I was supposed to come out here for an interview. And Trans-Canada Airlines, as it was then, went on strike. And so I couldn't get out here. So I accepted the job without ever having been to Calgary, and didn't know what to expect other than, as a kid, I always loved cowboys. I was so furious with my parents, because they called me Richard instead of Roy, after Roy Rogers. I used to go to the rodeos at Madison Square Garden every
year. Because you're from New York.
I'm from New York mm-hmm. City. New York City. How you doing? Anyway.
Forget about it.
Forget about it. Absolutely. And I started riding when I was 8 years old. My grandparents got me riding lessons. So I've ridden all my life. Mm-hmm. And I, when the job first came available, I said, boy, Calgary Stampede, Banff National Park, because I love to ski. We're going.
Now, what year was this?
1969.
Okay. So the university was very new. Just
3 years old.
3 years old?
Okay. 3 years old. And there weren't all these buildings. In fact, another aspect of my career here is that I've been living with everybody else in a construction site for, it'll be 46 years in June, or July. So I think the other high point of my career was when I discovered ethnomethodology and conversation analysis, because that's not the tradition I was taught in at Columbia, where I did my doctorate. Mm-hmm. I was in comparative studies and education and African studies at the Institute of African Studies and the School of International Affairs, and comparative studies and education at Columbia Teachers College. And that was a result of having taught for 2 years in East Africa mm-hmm. With my wife. And then we came out here, and through, I don't quite know, some kind of, I don't know whether you call it a spiritual journey, an intellectual journey, I had been a student of a Zen master in New York. Mm-hmm. And I came upon ethnomethodology in a book called Language Use and School Performance by Aaron Sickerl, who teaches at the University of California, San Diego, and some others, including Robert McKay, I don't know how he pronounces because I never met him, who taught at the University of Toronto. Mm-hmm. And he used a Zen aphorism at the beginning of his chapter in this book. And the book was about the ethnomethodological study of teaching and learning, including standardized testing. And that was something has always been an interest of mine, too, how standardized testing distorts. Mm-hmm. So through that kind of stuff, I started reading about ethnomethodology, which was a term coined by Harold Garfinkel.
And explain that term to me.
Ethnomethodology literally means the study of people's methods, ethno-people methodology study of. Study of people's methods. What methods? Our everyday lives. So it's a study of the social world and how we jointly create this social world that we live in, and how without our interaction, the social world by definition would not exist. So it's that, and then reading the work of Harvey Sacks, who actually was brilliant, but accidentally got killed when he drove into a construction site hole on a campus of one of the University of California campuses. And he was quite brilliant in conversation analysis. And all of that stuff made sense to me. I had been teaching comparative studies in the Faculty of Education at the University of Calgary, and I had classes where we talked about things, and the students would say when I made a generalization, but that's not true here or here. And I used to think and say, you're right, it's not. Mm-hmm. And I decided that all I was talking about was sort of crap, excuse the expression, and that I had to change. And I had to start talking about stuff that I really believed was the case. Mm-hmm. And ethnomethodology allowed me to make sense of our social world in all its aspects, including teaching and learning, in a way I'd never been able to do that before.
How has, other than, it sounds like, the ethnomethodology aside and your focus of your research and your study, how has education and how we teach people changed over the years for you? Let's take a step back. Have you seen a difference in the student? How have students changed?
Yes.
Or is that too big a question?
I've seen a difference in the students in the sense that they're much more knowledgeable and mature than they were when I first started teaching here. They're wonderful students. All my experience with my students is just so positive. I can't say anything bad about the students I've had. Wonderful. But when I first came here, students in some early classes, you would say, what do you think of Plato's theory of ideas? And they would say, you mean Mickey Mouse's dog?
Who's Plato?
And then I asked them about the Quran, and they hadn't a clue what the Quran was. But this was quite a while ago.
Well, the world's changed.
Yeah, you know, that's about 300-400 years ago.
I was going to say, do you think it's because you're more knowledgeable now, or do you think it's because they've become more knowledgeable? Is it a combination of the two?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of the two. Also, I have always thought, you know, people often say, well, if you can't do anything else, you teach. But all the students that I've had, so many of them just contradict that so much because they come from all sorts of different professions, from nursing, from engineering, from law. And they come, and I think people end up teaching, if they have a choice, because of personality. It suits their personality. They're not out to make a lot of money. They like being abused, and they,
it's more
joking,
about a passion.
But it's a passion, and they like having control. And even though you are stuck with a curriculum and you have principals and school boards and so on, when you're in the classroom, you still have a lot of freedom. And that's brilliant, and that appeals to a lot of people.
Well, and not many people can say that the jobs they have are being driven by their passions.
Yes.
And so, you know, I mean, I would say it would probably be the same thing for you then, that this has been a passion of yours because you've been at it for long enough. Obviously, you like it.
Yeah, I do, although if I had it to do over again, I would do it differently. I was an English major in university and in graduate work at the beginning of my graduate work. If I had it to do over again, I'd have studied mathematics and philosophy. I did some philosophy as an undergraduate.
That doesn't surprise me. The mathematics part does.
Yeah, that was my best subject in school. Mathematics, and in university, the highest mark I got at Columbia was A+ in statistics.
Hmm.
And I haven't a clue about statistics.
Well,
I just know it.
That's not surprising to me as a researcher. You know, as somebody who goes into research as an academic, that you'd have a high mark in statistics. That doesn't surprise me at all. But when you said math, I was a bit surprised by that.
Yeah. But so I would do that. So I don't know. I don't know why, but
no do-overs. What are you going to do now?
What am I going to do now? As little as possible.